I'm Vermont Edition producer Sam Gale Rosen. This podcast has been edited for brevity, and we hope you like it.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. She had planned on being sort of a free spirit in young adulthood, trying to see if she could make it as a cartoonist and musician. But when Rachel Lindsay was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, she realized she needed to chart a more conventional career path, one that came with health insurance. She took a job in advertising, but when she found herself working on developing advertisements for antidepressants, her professional and personal life collided in unhealthy ways. In her new graphic memoir, RX, Lindsay looks at how her life unraveled and how the circular system she was in led to that unraveling, and how making this new book helped her claw back some sense of control. Vermonters may know Rachel Lindsay from her comic strip In 7 Days called Rachel Lives Here Now. She describes it as a former New Yorker's quest to become a true Vermonter. She joins us today to talk about her work and her new book. Rachel, what a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
I really wish we could somehow like project your images onto people's brains as we have this conversation, because it's one of the downsides of radio, talking about a graphic memoir just with audio. So I apologize in advance that we don't have the technology yet to just imprint the images onto people's brains. But can you talk a little bit first about how you actually found yourself in a job in advertising, working on a Pfizer account that was trying to basically market antidepressants?
Well, I had interned for the ad agency Young and Rubicam during college, and I graduated in 2009, which was the beginning of the recession, and I got an offer from them, so I took it. So I started out working on the Campbell's campaign. I advertised Pace and Prego, and then I was given this opportunity to be promoted, and even though I very much felt conflicted about it personally, I was in it for the money. So that was that.
So what was the problem? Because in some ways, you can imagine that someone who has taken antidepressants, who deals with the kinds of issues that people would when you're taking antidepressants or when you have bipolar disorder, that in some ways you're sort of a great person to work on a marketing account, because you know maybe what works and doesn't work in targeting people who might need antidepressants. But did that make you feel like a vulture?
I mean, I didn't feel comfortable at all with anyone knowing that I was bipolar at that point in my life. And in the profession that I was in, especially in the role that I was in, it was very important that I was very straight-laced, and I was an account manager, not a creative. So at the end of the day, it was important that I was able to be very level, and I didn't have as much input on the creative process as, you know, some other people might.
So if it wasn't so there was this sense of, I don't want to reveal who I am, I don't want to reveal this part of myself. Was that because you feared job retaliation?
I don't know that I would have been fired. Like I said, that role that I was in really required a certain type of person. I didn't feel that if I were to reveal that I had a mood disorder, I would be trusted with managing the client's money.
Was there also a sense of, I don't like this kind of marketing? You know, there were images that you say, oh, this one really works. You know, this idea of somebody looking in a mirror and seeing a reflection, and whether the reflection is who they think they are or who they, you know, think they aren't, that was sort of an image that resonated with you. But then using the images that resonate to then sort of sell a drug to people, you know, could in some ways also feel wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because, you know, in the book, there is very much a slide into instability. And in the beginning, I did have this feeling of kind of weird empowerment, because I saw how they put everything together and that there were these very structured ways that they approached it. But once we actually got into the creative process, it just started to profoundly disturb me. And especially there was one meeting that I was in, I recall, where we were briefing the creative team. And of course, like, everything is just distilling all of this emotional trauma that I'd experienced into like bullet points for the creative team to make, you know, creative ads. And I remember one of the creative guys who was a director said, I already know the best happy pill on the market, ecstasy. And I think at that point, it really started to wear on me.
Rachel, you sometimes draw yourself with sort of Lupin qualities, and I want you to explain a little bit about that sort of wolf-like, dog-like image of yourself. It felt to me like it sort of morphed, and I could see different ways that that was appropriate, but I'd love to know more about your thinking in that.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because I feel very connected to that creature now, and I actually am doing a short kind of segue in Rachel Lives Here Now, where I am the wolf. I just wanted to have a really powerful visual for kind of this dangerous creature that was within myself, but also that was different enough from the way that the other characters are rendered that you'd really, really see, how my otherness and that. There are just so many associations with the wolf as being sort of this noble creature, but also very, volatile. And that really felt appropriate for my state of mind and my emotional state, going through that process.
Yeah, I like the wolf, and it's striking because it does stop you and make you think as you're looking at the images, like, okay, so what's happening here? Why is she a wolf now and not a wolf later?
And I mean, when I went to the Pfizer headquarters, that was like one of the most horrifying experiences of my life. Just I often just felt sick to my stomach when I was working on that campaign because, the closer that they were all normal people. All of my team, they weren't bad people. They weren't monsters, but they just weren't thinking about it in the same way I was. And I really felt such a strong otherness all the time. And it just intensified my own self-stigma and self-hatred that I had through the, episodes that I had experienced in college that were really awful.
Can you talk a little bit more about why it made you feel sick to your stomach to work on this particular campaign and not specific to Pfizer, but that relationship to drugs, to antipsychotic drugs, to antidepressant drugs that you feel both tied to and repulsed by in some ways?
Well, I think it's interesting to note that I was in college when I was diagnosed, and I wasn't watching TV, I wasn't reading magazines, and my dealings with my own prescriptions were just from a doctor. There was no intermediary, there was no commercial suggestion that I should be on these drugs. So to just be kind of thrown into what over the course of time that I was in college had become this huge industry and had really crested in 2009, 2010, which is like right when I graduated, I really was seeing this very disturbing other world, and it almost was like, I felt some level of disassociation. It was interesting to be confronted with.
You write right towards the beginning of the book to your readers, you probably won't know the shape of your unraveling until it happens. What was the shape of your unraveling?
Well, I had my first manic episode in 2007. I was in college and, it's this time of self-exploration and kind of, debauchery. And I think that I was also really discovering who I was as an artist and a musician and was making a lot of work and it was being responded to very well. And things just sort of got out of control after a certain point because I was becoming manic. And but there was no suggestion that I had that illness. And, I didn't know what was going on, but I was ruining my life. What happens is after you get medicated, you gradually have these moments of lucidity where you are, reflecting on things that you've done, and it's horrible. It's a horrible feeling. You just don't have that perspective.
So what does it feel like to you when you're manic?
It's just a real sense of being completely overwhelmed and out of control. I experience, these sort of self-propelled, I mean, it's hard because you feel like you're pursuing something that's authentic to yourself, and that there's a lot of circumstantial things that make what you're doing and how you're feeling valid. But at the same time, you're not able to fully function in society. And I think that I was lucky enough that I was highly functioning as a manic person up until the day that I was hospitalized.
So when you were hospitalized, is this a time in college, or are you speaking about the time working on the Pfizer account?
When I was hospitalized, the period in the book that was involuntary, that was my fourth manic episode. The rest had been dealt with outpatient, and I probably should have been hospitalized for the first one because it was terrible. And I've been told that part of your brain dies after you have a manic episode because you're firing so hard. And recovering from that is what makes the depression so profound. I have also been hospitalized twice for depression.
So the thing that you point out in the book, and that just seems so unfair, I guess could be one way to say it, is, you know, so you were diagnosed. You did everything that everybody told you to do. You went on medication. You saw a therapist. You got a job with health insurance so that you could continue to do the responsible thing. And then you're looking to these authority figures for help to say, you know, how do I control this, and how do I have a life that I want, but also I'm going to have to make sacrifices. I don't get to do that thing in my 20s where I wander around and see if I can make it because I need to have health insurance, and I'm doing it. And yet still you find yourself in another manic episode and dealing with this job that's just a mind bender because, you know, you're in this on this Pfizer account, and in some ways feeling like you're a little bit not of an imposter, but you're sort of hiding yourself within this. So how did that all happen when you were trying to do all the things that you were told to do that you still then found yourself involuntarily hospitalized?
Well, I mean, I think that is an impossible emotion to describe. And there's a chapter in the book called The Fool that took me – that's exactly about that. And it took me months to write, you know, six sentences. And I can't describe the feeling of, you know, I was in the psych ER describing how I had done every single thing I was supposed to do. I said it all to all the doctors, and they were like, "You're going upstairs." And I could not believe it.
And upstairs being into the psych ward.
Being into the ward, yep. But yeah, I mean, I still have a lot of anger about that. And I think that one thing that was really challenging for me in the book was to make my anger palatable to the reader and not lose them at the point that I was hospitalized because my anger was so unbelievable. Like, I just couldn't take it anymore. You know, I had done everything I was supposed to do, and now I'm supposed to listen to all of you. I don't think so.
You still feel that anger?
I mean, yeah, I do. But I mean, I think that now I know that I've had my chance to speak my piece about this, and the rest of that is going to have to come through my own work of dealing with that.
Talking to Rachel Lindsay about her book RX, and we're talking about this situation she found herself in and dealing with the fact that she had tried to do everything right to lead a healthy lifestyle, and then found herself in this situation and found herself with doctors saying, you know, you're not well, even though that's what she had been trying to be. If you have a question or maybe an experience that resonates with you here listening to this conversation, we'd like to hear it. Our number is 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Dave has a question about this particular time period and says, did Ms. Lindsay have a lawyer to help her fight getting put into the hospital? In most cases, the lawyer only puts up token resistance.
That's a good question. When I was first put in the hospital, they give you all of this paperwork about, you know, your legal options. And other patients also discussed that with me. But I decided not to pursue that because I didn't want to go to court, and it just was too overwhelming to me. And, you know, I've heard similar things to what Dave says. So I didn't take that option, but it is an option.
And Ivory writes in to say, did you have any education prior to being hospitalized about mania and delusions and psychosis? Do you think that such a horrible outcome could have been prevented with the right psychiatric support? Ivory also says, good job making people understand bipolar.
Oh, well, like we were just saying, I had every, you know, suggested support in the world. I think that what was missing was some credence by my, you know, the medical professionals in my life that I knew what I needed in that moment, and what I needed was to get out of New York and take a breather. And you know, it's those sort of being able to trust your inner resources and your inner voices as a bipolar person is one of the hardest things that you could possibly have to do, because you're told that your thoughts are insane. And I spent years pathologizing my creativity, and anything that made me feel like this is the right step for me, I'd be like, actually, I'm insane right now, right? So I think there needs to be more education about distinguishing between those things, and like just really getting down to how to parse that out, I guess. Just make people feel like they have some level of agency.
Did you tell people I need to take a break and feel like you weren't listened to or supported, or did you not even say that because you were worried that you couldn't trust yourself?
Oh, no, I certainly told people. It was not a plan that would have been functional. But, you know, one of the hardest things for me was that, you know, my parents didn't even have a conversation with me before they put me in the hospital. And just the assumption that, you know, I was just too out of control to be dealt with, you know, I certainly was pretty out of control. But I think that if I had been allowed to have a conversation in the right way, in which I felt respected by authority figures and my family, then it might have been different. I don't know.
When we come back, we're going to talk about how making this book, even in the time that she was hospitalized, Rachel Lindsay says this book was there. This book was in her mind. And this book has been a big part of being able to say her truth and put it out there in a way that can then be reckoned with. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with cartoonist Rachel Lindsay about her new graphic memoir, RX. And we'll talk about her comic strip that appears in 7 days, Burlington's Alt Weekly. That's called Rachel Lives Here Now. So you, in creating this book, talk about in the book how even while you were hospitalized against your will, even when you were feeling like this is a system that is not listening to me, I've tried to do the right things and nobody is actually listening to me and what I need, and the anger that you had about the situation that you found yourself in, that you were making artwork and you were detailing things and you were sort of creating this book, even if you didn't know what form it was ultimately going to take, during those sort of darkest days. Why was that so important to be doing this creative work that in some ways you had almost said, well, that's not going to be my career because I need to have, you know, I need to have health insurance. I need to work a 9-to-5. And then you sort of found that work was so important to you again.
I think that the story that I saw in my hospitalization and the events prior to that demanded that I return to this work. And I should also say that when I was not doing creative things in my job, it was extremely painful to me. And I would have to go to these parties where people remembered me as a creative person and then tell them that I work for the man. And while, you know, they're off doing whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think that it was a very slow start, and it was a very intense ending. But I really felt like I had a story to tell, and that it was a real story, and that it was powerful, and that I was capable of doing it. So I don't know.
The book, though, the book proposal that you sold was different than what eventually came out. You were originally sort of telling vignettes about other people that you met in the hospital, and that's not at all what this book is.
Yeah. I mean, it was tough because I did sell the book with a completely different turn, and actually, my original draft didn't have anything about my job, and it was more about kind of the, I think when you're in a mental hospital, there's all kinds of stuff that are that is really, you know, strange, and you want to report back to reality what it's like not to live in reality. But I then later felt like I was kind of making a spectacle of this and these people that I really cared about and was friends with. And, you know, there were stories about our relationship, but they weren't really stories about me and my development. And the reason that I was not able to talk about myself was because I didn't know how to deal with that descent into anger. But I'm happy with how it came out, even though it really hurt to throw that stuff away. I still love it.
You know, some people might say that the publishing industry is also the man these days. So did you have a good editor, a good publisher who, when you said, actually, it's a different book than what you bought, that were okay with that?
They were very understanding that this book was very personal and that it was taking shape during the process. Thankfully, they put up with me because it was really rough on me. But, you know, I think that they might have saw it, but it was much funnier before. So I'm glad that they were okay with it being heavy.
Let's go to some of our calls. Brian is calling in from Burlington. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome. What do you want to share?
Hello. Hi. So I wanted to bring into the conversation the idea of bipolar 2, which is it's bipolar. It's definitely bipolar, but some people have misconceptions about it. Some people think it's less serious, and I just wanted to offer the idea of, like, bipolar manifests in different ways for different people. And for me, I experience bipolar as a slightly elevated state, like not full-blown mania. It's actually called hypomania, and a very serious depression. And so, like, I do have bipolar. And when I'm hearing this, the dialogue about having to justify your thoughts and having to validate them and having to find ways to confirm to yourself that what you're thinking is actually real, I find that it's even harder for bipolar that not only is less readily understood, even though bipolar is already not very understood as it is, but bipolar that manifests differently in different ways for different people. And I just thought that was an important thing to bring into the conversation. And I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk about your experience. I very much appreciate it.
Brian, thank you for sharing your thoughts and your experience. Yeah, Rachel, I mean, bipolar disorder does have different types and different ways that it expresses itself for people.
Yeah, I mean, bipolar 2 is certainly, I don't like to say one is more serious than the other, but, that's so hard in the sense that you're not experiencing these extreme peaks and troughs, and it's just sort of like sliding along from what I understand. It's so challenging to be able to, know how to deal with that kind of elevation in daily life. And, I wish you luck being able to work through that.
Can you talk a little bit about how you draw yourself differently depending on what you feel like your mind frame is? Because there are ways that without necessarily saying something through words, you're expressing through your depiction of yourself in graphic form, like how you're feeling and what sort of is resonating in your body when you're feeling these different emotions and going through different phases.
Yeah, I really am obsessed with line work, and I always tell my students line is king. I just really like to flex that and kind of make that as emotive as possible. I think one of the biggest choices that I made was to have my manic eyes be these huge googly eyes. And you'll notice that my, stable self and all of the, sane people that are in the book have these dot eyes. And those big eyes let me have more range with the emotionality, but also are kind of a nice cue that, my perception has been altered. And there's, a distinct point where that clicks back that kind of has to do with my, concession.
Concession in what way? How do you see that?
I just recognized that my emotional self was no longer functional, and that I was capable of doing what they asked of me, in the, you know, on paper sense. I just wasn't going to do it, you know, with, you know, giving them all of my respect.
You know, you put in the book, and it's a very different graphic form than the rest of the book. You say at one point, I still have an illness. I still have to take pills. I'm still in this system. And yet, actually making this book helped you in what way? I mean, to have more control, to feel like you were putting something out there that needed to be said? I mean, you're still in the same system, and yet it feels different.
Well, I think about it as me reclaiming this time in my life, and especially given the fact that I have medical records from doctors describing my every feeling and emotion and the way I'm coming across. I requested my hospital notes. One of the notes was thought pattern, wants to show cartoon portfolio to the New Yorker, delusional. So wow. Having to read that in the process of this really fueled the fire.
Because I was wondering if you got your notes, because you do detail your medical notes. And I thought, is this what you imagine people were writing about?
I felt
you?
Obligated. You know, I felt like it would be dishonest for me not to read them. And I also was trying to make sure that my understanding of the sequence of events was accurate. But it really sets up this thing where I just felt like I needed to have the last word about this, and there it is.
Have you shown your portfolio to the New Yorker?
No.
Not yet?
Yeah, not yet. Not yet.
Let's go to Mikhail calling in from Danby. Hi, Mikhail.
Hey, how's it going? My name is Mikhail, and I'm calling from Danby. Great to hear you, Rachel. I'm so stoked. I just tuned in, you know, 12:30 on a Tuesday, a beautiful Tuesday, and I, you know, as a 30-year-old female, was diagnosed with bipolar at 27, and I just wanted to say I'm so stoked to hear somebody talk about, you know, the reality of the anger that you felt. You know, I can connect with you, you know, pretty hard on being told, you know, you're going upstairs when you're just trying, you know, your best to reach out for the help that you need at the time, you know, going to the hospital and saying, hey, I'm not feeling quite right. I'm bipolar, you know, this is me, this is who I am, this is what I'm feeling. And having somebody, you know, in our institutionalized medicine, you know, medical system, take over, you know, I almost felt like my rights were taken over when somebody, and I did feel, you know, I felt, you know, justifiably angry when somebody told me, you know, like, you're going to get put on, you know, on the involuntary psych ward. You know, it's part of my story is that I've been, you know, institutionalized, you know, many times, sometimes, you know, on my own, out of my own volition. And sometimes the choice was made for me by doctors who, you know, I'm assuming it was, you know, they were practicing out of their own best, you know, to the best of their ability. But I do still, you know, still have, you know, very angry memories. And it's wonderful to hear a strong woman talk about the ways that you can heal from those angry moments and what you can do creatively to kind of, you know, like, your life is not over because you're a bipolar woman. You know, like it's not, I'm almost speechless. So great to hear you.
Thank you so much. I'm almost crying. So thank you. That really, really means a lot. I really thank you so much. Appreciate that.
A lot of people sharing a perspective here, Rachel, of, you know, yes, this resonates. This you're speaking for yourself, but you're also exposing and illuminating how other people feel, and that lack of, you know, lack of trust they feel, like people don't believe you when you say something. And then how do you deal with that in yourself? That this clearly resonates with people. Nina says, I really resonated with the feeling of I did everything right. As someone with PTSD and unipolar depression, I find it difficult to navigate a normal life. I've gone to college, obtained a degree, and yet somehow it seems that even though I did everything right, I can't seem to fit into any conventional mold. Vicky says, I'm so happy you're writing about this subject. As a psychiatric nurse for 20 years in the locked unit, I can say without a doubt that bipolar to bipolar experience is the best way to help someone. And let's go to Pooja, who's calling in from Duxbury. Hi, Pooja. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Rachel, I just want to say, again,
like other people have said, thank you so much for being a strong female voice, talking about mental health issues, having gone through a traumatic experience where you're doing everything right and you're in the place that's supposed to help you and you feel stigmatized even in that moment. And one thing that comes up for me, I'm a therapist in Vermont, and I always think about how everybody's parts actually make sense. So the parts that wanted to act out or that wanted to be creative, each of those parts has stories, and each of them maybe has traumas that they're working through, and some parts are completely liberated. But just really honoring that your parts, even though they're extreme in some moments, really are amazing and really want the best for you. So thank you for taking the call.
Yeah, I also thank you so much, and I appreciate what you said about the parts aspect of it, because I recently have been doing some therapy that encourages that sort of conception of self as parts, and I've just kind of found fascinating parallels as a cartoonist that, you know, creates these different versions of myself all the time, as that being a really excellent compliment, and it has been really helpful for me.
So do you still have health insurance?
Yeah,
because you know, one of the things that you said was it's interesting that it took this experience to sort of bring that ability to say, yes, I want my career to be in cartooning back to the forefront. And yet you still feel that pull. You have to have a job that comes along with health insurance, which I imagine cartooning typically doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually kind of interesting because I think that there is very little education about the options that you have for health insurance. And I mean, you know, I am on Medicaid, and another cartoonist actually told me about being on Medicaid, and that completely changed my life. I am living, you know, basically the life that I want to live. And I mean, it's limiting in some ways, but, you know, I think that there should be, I never ever would have considered that. I never in my life, I just didn't associate that with something that was an option for me, and look what I'm able to do.
I want to ask you slightly off-topic question about the significance of 11N. Mm. It looks like it might have been the early working title for your book, and your memoir has a lot of clipboards, and not just the words that are on the clipboards, but the clipboards themselves are clearly important in the work.
Yeah.
And the clipboard, one of the clipboards has 11N
yeah,
on it.
Yeah, 11N was the ward that I was hospitalized in New York Presbyterian Hospital, and 11N was the name of the ward that I was in. But yeah, the clipboards, I just wanted that was my attempt at indicating that what was written on them was actually real medical notes. So, and I wanted that to appear very distinctly as a visual to separate it from my own story.
Your book is actually out today.
Yes.
Today is the launch date officially for RX. What are you doing to celebrate?
I'm here with you.
What could be better?
Yeah, no, I'm just having a pretty quiet day, but the big day is Thursday. I'm having a launch event at Phoenix Books in Burlington, and it's at 7 p.m. So anyone who is interested in my book or hearing more or asking me more questions should please come.
How do you see the similarities or the sort of digression from your work on your weekly strip that runs in 7 days called Rachel Lives Here Now, which you describe on your website as, you know, somebody who's originally from New York, but someday you'll be a bona fide Vermonter?
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing for me to come here and start doing Rachel Lives Here Now, because I was coming fresh from having this corporate job and corporate identity. And then I had, you know, these amazing epiphanies being here and loving being here. And so that version of myself is really like where I rediscovered my joy, you know, that I really hadn't had for years and years. And, you know, it's changed quite a bit, but that first year is really just like purely my rediscovery of myself. And when I was working on the book, it was actually very hard to do the strip because I was, you know, I was barely living my life because I was spending all day reflecting on my past. And then I would just have to conjure this, you know, pretend present life, you know, for the strip. But, you know, it definitely is something I look forward to sharing every week. And I'm very pleased that, you know, people enjoy it.
Well, you can see more of that work, Rachel Lives Here Now, and more about the book RX, which is officially out today on Rachel's website. We have a link at vpr.net. You can click on Vermont Edition. You'll also find information there about her readings, including the one this Thursday. Rachel Lindsay, author of RX, thank you very much for talking with us. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.